This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Well, today I'm going to show you I have ADHD. I'm jumping around this text. So good luck. I'm starting with, on page 101, the Buddha says to Mahamati, Bodhisattvas should become adept at seeing no self in anything at all. Bodhisattvas should become adept at seeing no self in dharmas, soon gain an insight into the freedom from projections that characterize the initial bodhisattva stage, and they delight in examining the characteristics of such awareness. We should become adept at seeing no self in anything, in everything, in it all. And bodhisattvas delight in examining the characteristics of such awareness, the characteristics of awareness. So Annette yesterday asked about awareness, mind, consciousness, and one other thing I forgot.
The brain.
Okay. So, I don't know if any of you have ever heard of the Baal Shem Tov.
What?
The Baal Shem Tov is a Jewish being, enlightened being. He talks about that awareness actualizes the potential of the presence. Awareness actualizes the awareness of the present. And where the thought of a person is, there the entire person is. Where the speech of a person is, there the entire person is. Where the action of a person is, there the entire person is. So it's another way of where our awareness is, our entire being is in that state, which when we examine the paramitas, our awareness is in the paramitas, our entire being is in that examination. When we are in the anger realms, our entire being is in that hell realm. I want to return to part of a quote that you gave about ultimate truth, that words are not ultimate truth, nor is what they express ultimate truth. Ultimate truth is what Buddhas delight in, and what words lead to is ultimate truth. What words lead to is ultimate truth. But words are not ultimate truth. Ultimate truth is what is attained by personal realization. And to me, realization is an experience. It's a living experience, realization, when we realize we're experiencing ultimate truth. and it's beyond words. And it's not a realm known by means of the projection of words. Therefore, the projection of words do not express ultimate truth, but they lead to it or point to it. And so in our sitting, we get to taste realization of many, many kinds. And you have to realize this before you can realize that. And you have to see that it is not this to see that it is not that. And those are realizations and experience. Now I'm jumping to page 177 because it talks about one of my favorite topics, desire, anger, and delusion. I mean, for myself. There are two things the Buddha says that people in the world depend on. I assume these are ordinary beings, and we're also ordinary beings. They depend on existence and on non-existence. And as they fall prey to existence and to non-existence, they try to imagine escape where there is no escape. We try to imagine maybe tomorrow. And when really there's no escape from right now. One of my monk colleagues in SPOT, he told of sitting with Suzuki Roshi. He and his wife sat with Suzuki Roshi back in the late 60s. And he was doing okay, but his wife was really struggling with sitting, with this practice. And he said that his wife went to see Suzuki Roshi. She said, "I just can't do this. I can't do this. I gotta go." And he said, "Okay. It's okay, you can go. But it'll still be there. You know, what you're trying to escape from, it'll still be there, whether you go or not." And I think she stayed to work through some of that. So, is there an escape? And how, Mahamati, does the world depend on what does not exist? Once people think of desire, anger, and delusion as existing, they imagine the non-existence of desire, anger, and delusion. That by not perceiving their existence, the characteristics of their existence become still. Therefore, they think because they don't perceive the existence of desire, anger, and delusion among Tathagatas, Shravakas, or Pratikabuddhas, they exist, then don't exist. Mahamati, not only are these thoughts nihilistic in regard to existence and non-existence of desire, anger, and delusion, these afflictions cannot be seen internally or externally, and because their existence is different and not different, Mahamati, desire, anger, and delusion cannot be seen internally or externally because desire, anger, and delusion have no substance. And because there is nothing to see. Desire, anger, and delusion have no existence, no substance, and therefore there is nothing to see. So now to dive into what I'd like to speak to today. That both Vasubandhu and this sutra talk about our perceptions and also our projections. And what I appreciate about this text is on page 117 in section 32, it talks about word projections. Maybe there are other kinds of projections. Movie screen projections are wonderful. Word projections are wonderful too. But the Buddha talks about them as being four kinds of word projections. There are object words, dream words, words attached to hostile events, and words that derive from habit energy, seed energy, seeds of past attachments from the repository consciousness. So object words arise from attachment to the projection of forms and characteristics. Dream words arise from recalling previously experienced realms that upon waking are found to be non-existent. And words of attachment to mistaken projections arise from recollecting previous acts of hostility. And that's what I'd like to speak to, is these mistaken projections that result from recalling previous acts of hostility. So these four types of projections, word projections, object words, dream words, recalling events of hostility and the habit seeds. This is a recent revelation, and thank you, Annette, for asking a question of me the other day, because it became a little clearer. I was telling her about there used to be a lot of bay laurel trees that grew next to these buildings. And we don't have any growing next to them anymore. And we just recently took down an oak. But there were these roots in the ground. You know, they cut them off to level with the ground, and the roots were there. And the place, you know, wasn't quite right to me. And most people don't care about roots. You know, they just see them, oh, you know, that's a big root. I don't want to deal with that. But then events in community would happen here, and boy, would I get hot. I would just get so passionate about what had just transpired. I would bristle. I wouldn't say anything to anybody. I'd just bristle, having this intense energy. What would I do with it? Well, there's a stump that needs to be moved, taken out of the ground, because the feng shui in this area is not right. So I dive into this root, and I start digging around it, and I was like, why did I ever start this thing, you know? And then people would come up and say, what are you doing? oh, I'm digging out this root. Well, can I help? I said, yeah. I felt like Tom Sawyer. And there were probably over the years, 40, 50 people had helped out on this. You never probably thought of ever digging out a root, but getting back to the passion of this, recalling hostility, I would just feel so passionately angry at somebody here. I couldn't look at them. I couldn't talk to them. I just keep my distance, and I'd head for the root and dig and dig and dig and cut the roots and dig some more and dig under the root and actually be able to crawl under the root to get all the dirt out from under the root so I could put a bottle jack underneath it to jack it up so it's level with the ground and I could, you know, move it away. There are several around here. And so that's the fun part of this. So I was recalling this hostility, or having this hostility, and the object words were them who did this dastardly thing. Why would they do that? So those are the object words, and the dream words is the narrative I'd come up with about the whole thing, you know, whether it was done out of ignorance or out of malintention. You know, of course it was malintention. So I was working through these roots, digging them out, and I'd find that by the time I got done digging the root and getting it out of the ground, there was an elation. And the anger was gone, and I could kind of get back to normal, but I don't know, it probably didn't get back to normal for other people, because when you bristle and, you know, it's there's a lingering distaste, I think. So I went and talked to my mom, who was another passionate person, and I said, you know, I got this anger, you know, people notice it, that I'm angry. Can you help me out? She said, well, righteous anger is helpful. I said, what doesn't help me, Mom? So I'll go back to this righteous anger, and there were several more roots to take out. But what I want to get to is that this righteous anger that I had was something my mom had. And is it something that is genetic? Is it something, it's somewhere in the repository, somewhere. But after 6, 8, 10 roots of working through this anger, again and again, and finding it arise and needing another root, man, it would be 2 days I'd get a root out of the ground. I think I burned up most of those seeds. And I needed to go through that in order to burn it up. And so I'm just using this as an example of the seed repository, the repository consciousness holds a lot, and eventually one can work through it. I felt like I was able to work through it, so that kind of righteous anger just hasn't come up again. There are all these other karmic seeds to deal with. And it is said that karma is relentless. So I want to today have us kind of discuss projections, or, you know, we see it as perceptions, but I hope it's been helpful to see that there are these word objects, dream words, and our remembrances of acts of hostility that have been done to us or that we feel towards others. And it's the repository of these habit energies of actions and words that we use. I know in the practice of when you're learning an instrument and you play a measure, if you play it wrong 5 times, you have to play it, practice it 50 times to unlearn it, to get it right. So just that example shows how habitual tendencies tend to linger. And so to master a measure and then master it again and again and again so that it is set, then it becomes the habit, the pattern to follow. And perhaps the perfection of a measure of music, the perfection of a line of prose, the perfection of understanding of a precept, an aspect of the precept in the context in which you're dealing with it, helps to refine this path that we each have that's unique to each of us. So I'm going to stop there. And hello, Peter.
Hi, Doug, and everybody there in the Zendo.
Lots of people.
Thank you for the tour.
I had a question about the first excerpt you read. What does it look like to see no self?
It looks like this. This is it. So to see yourself, you're seeing yourself as you are in the context of all of this. Could you be anything? Could you be you without this container right now holding you? Could I be, I could not take this seat without this here? And what to you is no self?
It feels like a concept. It feels like something that I don't see myself or feel. And so I wonder what is that that's in the way?
Can you feel the connection to this? Feel this. So we are tactile beings, and we feel not only with our skin and touch, but we feel with our eyes and ears and our senses. I can do this, and he can feel I touched your aura in a way, or maybe it was just wind that passed by you. But where does, when self are this, you know, we can make, look at the individual characteristics of self. You're 6'4 or 6'5, and you're, you know, you weigh a certain, have a certain mass, and you have a certain genetic code inside you. You know, we can look at all these characteristics. So is there a self there in the height? Is there your, is there self in your height? Is there a self in your genes, in your cells? Is there a self in the exhalation of your breath? Where do you find self? It's, I think we find self in our attachment to, this is mine. You know, when we feel something is mine, then there's that attachment. And, but then, is this mine? Or is this mine? Or is this mine? Or is this mine? So it's illusory. No self is illusory, just like self is illusory. But I think what it means, no self, is that in the midst of self is all of this inability to touch every aspect of self. That we investigate self in this practice. We investigate what arises in our mind. And like Dogen said, you know, to study the self is to study Buddhism. To study Buddhism is to, you know, to study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to not be able to find the self except in the myriad things. And so when you actually feel that with your heart, with your body, with your mind, then there's a about, I feel this connection. And maybe that's connection is the no self.
It seems like the language they used there was see, and Sophie Zahn often talks about seeing, and I hear you talk about feeling. Is that the same immediacy, just talking about a different sense field?
Mm-hmm. John?
Piggybacking on what he was just asking about, and perhaps the quote was from, I think you said, someone, a Jewish mystic, but mm-hmm. You said, if you're angry, the whole self is in the hell realm. Which self? I mean, that's always confusing to me when we say things like that, but we say there's no self.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm asking, that's all.
So to as I read the other day, a statement about self is about no self. A statement about the earth is about no earth. And in a way, it's like, what is the context of, what are the myriad contexts that it can be in? So it's, you have to, we have to see, I think, the one, not one, not two. And that's again and again and again. Does that help?
Yeah.
I'm not getting it. Okay, when you say, I mean, I can understand opposites, you know, light and dark, heat and cold, self and no self. How is a no self the opposite of the self? I mean, it sounds like you're talking about opposites. All these statements sound like opposites, right? And you got self and you got no self. And you got, you know, how does, what is that? I guess he just asked for that. I just don't get it.
So this is a table.
Exactly.
And in the midst, this table is also not a table. In this way, it has density, it came from a tree, it feels like wood, there's a black lacquer on it, and it's also sitting on bamboo and on the earth, and it has a shape and form. The table would not be a table unless its context in the bigger way. You can understand a table as a table, just as a table. That's ordinary thinking. But at the same time, you see it as a table, and you also see it as where it came from, how it was put together, the age of it, the context of the being on the earth in the solar system, and it becomes, then it's both. It's not like an opposite, it's like seeing the big context of it.
Well, that's a description on the table. When you say it's wood, it's this, you're describing the vessel of the table, all surrounding. When you say self and no self, no self is a description of what?
No fixed self.
I mean, we have a genetic code, we have a physical self. Mm-hmm. The genetic code gives rise to each unique person. Everyone has a different genetic code. So that's uniqueness. No one else in the whole universe has your code.
Is your genetic code fixed?
It's fixed, but it's plastic also. It's fixed at birth. It's actually fixed before birth. It's fixed, your mother and father fix your code before, in the egg. The genetic code is fixed by the mother, and then whoever fertilizes, then it's fixed again. Mm-hmm. And then those eggs and sperm in the embryo are already laid down for the next generation.
Are they fixed?
They're fixed and they're plastic at the same time. Because they're fixed by...
How can it be fixed if it's plastic?
Well, it can be both, because it can be modified.
There you're beginning to get into the non-self realm when it's plastic.
Well, everything is plastic.
Exactly.
That's the point.
Everything's plastic. Everything is flowing.
What was it? Okay. It's becoming word twisting.
Is a hot dog a part of a baseball game?
No, hot dog is meat. I mean, you're playing a word. I mean, that's not a definition. It's just semantics.
What is the part of a baseball game then?
Let's go back to genetic code. That's concrete. I mean, you know, everyone's got a unique genetic code. And of course, it gives rise to you. Your genetic code gives rise to you. But there's so many things that influence the expression of each protein. I mean, it's infinite. It's infinite, isn't it? You can't even conceive that number. There's not a computer on earth that can give you that infinite combination of things that make you. And then when that's defined, something else happens and you're different. Okay? That I can see that's real. You're always changing. Nothing's the same. Nothing from one instant to the next. It's different. But the no self and self, it's all still self.
What you just described was a great description of no self. Of the infinite, indescribable that comes together to make this, that is the how it, that is where it all comes from. It is that closely fitting, the self and no self. It is that tight.
I'll have to get my head around this one. You gave me something to think about next year.
It's hard around it, not your head. Huh? Maybe get your heart around it, not your head.
Yeah, bring it down here. Think about it here. Think about these things, these concepts of self and no self staying up here. They just swirl around and it stays quite circular. It doesn't spiral. Bring it down into the body. Like Amanda said, it's explore it in the heart.
Kind of have to feel it, not think it.
Jerome? Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about relationships? Because I have friends or partners or whatever, and I'm relating to those selves. I have clear ideas about those selves. And so when they're not really selves, what am I relating to?
Well, to the selves and not selves. It's when we realize that self is plastic, that it's moving, flowing. Then that's to me a sense of seeing self and no self at the same time. Attaching to particular characteristics, sometimes it's important to attach. It's like, oh wow, my fingernails are too long. I better do something about it. So you tend to that. But where did the fingernail come from? You know, well, it came from my mom and dad because my genes made it, so it came out. I can dwell on that. Or it came from all the food that passed through me, and here it is. So here's my relationship with my finger, but with relationship with friends and important ones, there is self, but the self dissolves again and again. And our entire structure, our tissue is replaced every 7 years, something like that, you know, completely. So our past memories are something that we can access as a memory, but to reconstitute it as a fixed event is, it's over. And that's why I think this metaphor of the waterfall is helpful, because it shows that there is duration, you know, of a droplet. There's a duration of a droplet coming down by itself, and it's unique and it's amazing. And then it merges, re-emerges in with the rest, or vaporizes in with the atmosphere. So just there's no fixity and in relationship either, because the context always change. Does that touch your question, Jerome?
Yeah, that gives me the sense that maybe that's one reason a lot of relationships are so difficult, because we get fixed. We have the fixation, but person is such, rather than that they are plastic.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. There was a question here a moment ago, but wait, okay. Tim?
Yeah. You mentioned you know, this dependent co-arising, and then that's when that's happening, you're kind of, you're in the moment, you're not suffering. But then you say this anger comes up. And there's a certain power there, right? Like, yeah, I got power on earth too. And it's justified.
Right? Absolutely justified.
But, you know, resentments are, you know, you drink the poison and the other wait for the other person to die. I mean, you're just doing this thing to yourself.
Sure.
Which is taking you away from the dependent co-arising.
Sure.
Of the no self. So why do you do that to yourself? And when you're digging in the roots there, I know it's compelling because it's right in your face. Right in your face and you're fighting with it. My problem with some of this is that when I'm in the middle of it, I find I can't accept that the other person can't be something that they're not. And that's what pisses me off. But that's an illusion, right? I'm just doing that to myself. So how do you not do that to yourself?
By going through that 1,000 or 10,000 times. And by the 10,000th first time, it's like, I've done this a few times. It hasn't worked. So maybe I'll try something else. I think it's the repeating of it. And for me, like the extinguishing of those seeds of intense passion, I had to do it again and again and again. And the first few times it was like I didn't even think about the trouble of what I was getting into and doing with the root because I was just so furious, you know. I was like, more, more, more. But after a while, I was like, why am I doing this? So the repetition of going through this is what we have to do. And in a way, that's what Sasheen helps us with in seeing it arise again. And again, and sometimes it's quite interesting. And after a while, like the 50th time of the same thing coming up, it's like, it's not so interesting anymore. Is it necessary to look at this? So we move on.
Oh, yeah. Or talk to your teacher. I mean, you can reach out. I can't do this myself. So I reach out. And, you know, the teacher or the Sangha can help me to come back into this dependent co-arising. Mm-hmm. The Sangha helps me to do what I can't do myself. So does the teacher.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Ekuro?
Doug, did you, with this anger that you had, this passion, mm-hmm. Did you ever think of looking inside as the root of that passion inside instead of doing it outward toward the root?
Sure. Sure, I did. Yeah. Many times. During Sasheen, many times, and I just remember even in Sasheen being furious and going to knock on Mike's door and say, this isn't working. You know? Mm-hmm. And then finally I got to the place where it's like, and I laugh. So the roots of this sometimes do not appear. And maybe it doesn't matter to find them because they're in the repository, which cannot be defined where it is, or it just erupts. And so, but patterns that we see, we can perhaps work with, and that passionate quality, I know it still lingers with some people I know, you know, that it's still too fresh maybe with some. And there might be a fixity in their view that Doug's this way, you know, and forget him. Mm-hmm. And there isn't much to do until something else changes. And, yeah, I try to find the source of it, and seeing that my mother was passionate and she'd throw a plate on the floor when she was mad at us as kids, frustrated. But being able to pin it down, I see it more as a habitual thing, as maybe it's a genetic thing, because that passion is something I've seen in many of my relatives. Some of them, not all of them, but some have had that, and it's poisonous in many, manifesting in many, and others it's not there. So we each got to work with our own stuff. I don't know. I tried to look and find, you know, I read a definition, maybe it was in here, of Tathagata. It's a heap of crap with a jewel inside. It's all crap.
Nora's had a question for a while.
Yeah, Nora. Thanks for putting me back on track.
It was something that arose out of what Jerome said. The fixed self and the more fluid self that really appears in relationships, right? Like, probably most with our spouses, with our partners, right? Like we fixate on this is who they are, and resentment arises, and regret about our own inability to change. And I think that's, like, for me, that's a good example of fixed self. And I just want to share a practice that me and my husband have, that we agreed upon. When you're in the morning, when you're in a rush, it can happen that you just kind of brush by each other and you're like, yeah, this is Nico. And he goes, this is Nora, and she's doing her thing, and you just miss each other because you're having that fixed idea of each other. So what we're trying to do is when we meet in the morning, we try to meet each other new.
Mm-hmm.
We try to just take a moment and just allow for the other to maybe show up differently, and allow for ourselves to show up differently and to see the other maybe just a little more, just a little differently. And it's been really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
To just be aware of our fixations and to make space for, almost like imagining like the light is wiping out everything and you're meeting new every morning and just really fully meeting each other. And I think that, you know, gives space for new things to be seen and discovered in a relationship and for a relationship to change. Doesn't work every morning, but that's the intention. We try.
Thank you, Nora, for that. There's a story Paula Arai, who helped develop vows here, shared in the workshop she did with Beata here. And she talked about some women in Zen in Japan relationships there are very contentious too, like always happens in that. And this one lay practitioner suggested and then started implementing this, similar to what you do with your husband. But when it was time to talk, they would gosho to each other. And just that would change how they approached the next moment. It gave that little bit of space, like you're talking about, to see it anew, mm-hmm. or see new possibilities. Thank you for that. Does that help, Jerome?
Just in that same vein, I thought it would be worth sharing, because it's similar to something we do at Soku Koji, particularly with relationship, is having regular interviews with our partners. And it works when you're both meditators, so it's not like you're forcing something. But when we start, after we bow, we spend at least 60 seconds looking in each other's eyes before we speak. And Soku Zan kind of talks about like returning to the original intention. And something Senshu and I used to do every night for 1 to 4 minutes of just looking at each other's eyes. And it kind of helps go below the concepts, and you see, you see the human being, you see the original inspiration to be together. Is very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Curtis?
I think yesterday, or I can't remember, the day before, we were talking about kind of the same subject, but we were using the words small self and big self, I believe. And those are the words that the group I sit with in Senegal uses. Small self, the way I think about it is like, you know, the role I play, Curtis, I'm from Tennessee, yada yada. Big self is like, you know, everything else that includes me. And then, you know, the practice of like bowing is sort of like remembering to let go of the small self. And last night, Tim and I were talking about haikus, and Tim told me he was a painter, and he was trying to do like a visual representation of a haiku. And so we were bouncing around ideas to see what made a good haiku. And my take on it was, sometimes a good haiku has like two opposites. It presents two opposites, the black and white. But then the way it turns into a good haiku is, you're applying this third piece, whether it's your mind or this like dropping away when you read it, and it sort of creates this space and this leap. And I think the thing we came up with was like, the third thing is like maybe the mind. I don't know, the bigger mind. Am I getting that right, Tom?
The two images kind of make a third thing. There's a little leap there, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, you were saying, and you have to engage in order to make that.
Yeah, and it kind of made me think about, in practice, it's like, the teacher or the Sangha kind of does like half the work for you, and you gotta apply the other half. Hmm. And so it's sort of like, the haiku is kind of like being aware of the opposites, and then maybe being aware of them also being the same, and also just dropping away completely. I don't know. It's hard to say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, fascinating to embody a haiku in a painting, and that those relationships, and even the meter, which has to do with texture. Mm. Thank you. John?
Except self and no self are not opposites, are they? They're the same thing. It's like, I mean...
Not one, not two, yeah.
Yeah, not one, not two. But they're not opposites.
No.
Okay.
I guess sometimes I see a form like a table, and then it said no form, and I saw okay, but then there's everything else around it. When there's no form, there's kind of the outline of it. It disappears and everything else appears, which gives the context for what it appears in. We need both the particular and the general. We need both the form and the formless. We need and those statements that read in a statement about birth is about no birth. A statement about passion is about no passion. How can there be passion if there isn't lack of passion? It would all be passion. So and passion, no passion or passionlessness is not opposite passion. It's also present while passion is present.
One of the ways that we've talked about this in our Sangha is that delusion is seeing form, but it's the only thing we have because it's the way our brain works. Our brain functions by comparisons, mm-hmm. taller, shorter, fatter, thinner, whatever those are. And that's how we get to life. I mean, it's how we describe things here, but ultimately that's a delusion because of the interconnection of all things.
And the plasticity, like, to use Michael's word, the plasticity of things.
Like the description I've always liked is Thich Nhat Hanh's, when I was reading one of his books, and he said, he was talking both about impermanence and interdependence, and he said, if you can look at this book and see the tree that these pages came from, and the man who made the paper, and the man who cut down the tree, and he just kind of expanded that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the closest I've come to seeing yourself, I think, is based on those ideas. And admittedly, their ideas are concepts, but that's kind of how I see it.
Mm-hmm.
I know that's helpful.
Yeah, that is. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Emily?
The start of your talk today had to do with a woman who wanted to leave the Zendo and then decided to stay because, I guess, the Zen master, I guess, I'm not sure, he said, you're just going to have to face eventually, and she's hopefully worked things out. I really appreciate that because it seems like our not facing what is rising may be the very thing, the very seed that makes us project it outside of ourself, and like it's not in us, it's the Zendo. And we miss this moment that we have to connect with our very foundation of where all things arise from. And once we can get into that foundation and be with that, it's no longer a problem. Like there's no more betraying that. If we're betraying it by projecting it, is what I'm getting from this talk yesterday and today, is like, that's, we're doing that,
mm-hmm.
nobody else.
Mm-hmm.
and how amazing and what a responsibility it is to come back and not project and not feel like something out there is causing the problem. So I hear the importance of sitting.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
In our relationships, be it with someone or escaping someone, what is it that we are running away from?
I can't tell you because I've run away from it. So what is it I'm running away from? Not confronting it. Or running away from something here. So maybe, I guess in sitting with what we're running away from, we might find we need a faster car first, but then realize that it's up on blocks and it's not going to go anywhere. So you have to just get out and meet it. And there are other times where there's no choice, but you have to meet it in the moment because that's kind of how the catastrophe is unfolding. And when you see your child begin to fall, it's like, are you able to, you might be able to catch them. In the moment. Yeah, it's life is a problem. And it seems like for me, practice has helped to investigate these problems in kind and generous ways to myself, and it becomes more generous to others too in time. What do you see as the example? What came to mind for you?
It's interesting because, like, when you share this, that with some people, there's still a lingering of your mutual past that they run away from, but it's no longer present. So it's kind of like you keep living in your delusions. So it's not even a reality now. And keep playing this relation. And sometimes this living with the past and living with conceptions lead to conflicts, sometimes quite big ones. So that's why I'm curious, how do you turn whatever you have into not avoiding and not escaping?
By meeting it in the eye for a while, gently. Like you described with your partner. Maybe it's just that. Maybe it's just meeting it quietly for a moment and then again and again and again. It's really hard to give up the, especially when circumstances injured this body or another friend's body. It's hard when there's injury, it's hard to give up on it. And I'm know hardly anything about trauma. I've been a blessed person and not having hardly any trauma in my life. But those that have investigated trauma may have something to say about it, how they can meet it, how they can have it become still. Not that it isn't vibrant too, but there's, your example is a good one of like, you know, 4 minutes, 1 minute or 4 minutes of meeting the gaze. I'm an eye avoider, you know. Some people, my eyes are going all over. So maybe that'd be a good practice for me. At this late stage. To dwell in, because things do settle in that moment of looking at it for that's where I think the context of community, the structure of community, the forms of community have a lot to say in how the flexibility remains. When hierarchy is fixed, it's kind of hard to deal with flexibility. And one of the aspects of Jikoji that has helped me tremendously is this idea of no fixed hierarchy. And there's hierarchy here. For example, at the beginning of this, I was waiting for Jiu-san and Yun to begin serving tea, but they weren't ready to until I gave. You were using hierarchy to me, yet you were the hierarchy. You were the top element in that moment of serving. And so when you see it's ready to serve, you serve. It's how it can be. And that's where being in a position of authority is a dangerous position. Because it can be, especially when it's fickle. And our culture is one that has is pretty hierarchical, patriarchal. Those with the most money have the most power, and so men have more power, white skin has more power. And yet there are communities of people that have lived, that live now and have lived in the past, where, for example, among Native peoples, where in times of peace, where people are going out to
forage or cultivate or to maintain the day, there's there is a hierarchy because there's a chief, but the chief takes his orders from others in the community who say, hey, look over here, look over there, that one needs help. And it's probably from the women. And so his authority came from the women and others who knew what was going on as well as his insight to say, oh, look at this one. The mother's died. We have to take care of this baby. He comes into my tent and I'll take care of him. And so instead of like, oh, his mom's gone, let's let him go. So our culture does not, along with the hierarchy, does not include responsibility, full responsibility. Elon Musk, does not contribute to the highway systems that his employees drive on. Or he doesn't support the water systems that his employees drink from. He doesn't pay taxes. And it's all his money, and it's the, and yet it's from the efforts of labor. Labor brought him his fruit, and he ignores it. He can ignore it because that's how our system is at the moment. But in other times, maybe other places even now, there's a shared recognition. There's an accountability so that, how many pairs of shoes does he need? How many cars does he, can he drive at one time? How many beds can he live in? How many homes can he have to stay in? When my little shed is more than I need, you know, I got more than that. And it's like, wow. But so I ask each of you to hold me accountable. Because to me that is will help me help everybody. And so maybe that's how that I can't run, Anton, is when it's brought right up, and that's actually a functioning of the health of the community you have, where you actually, when an issue arises, like it's time to talk about it, and not just talk behind about it. Nora?
Question on this, when you're saying you're avoiding somebody, is that somebody or something that you have been hurt by? You felt hurt by in the past?
Yeah, that usually is the case. And there's something, or pain is involved, mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So the way I like to think of this is, in the moment we have been hurt, there's a little part within ourselves that almost manifests, and it's fixed, right? Like we have this fixed idea of ourself, and we're kind of stuck there a little bit in that hurt. And then we keep evolving, as all of us do every day, and we grow, but when we look at this person, that little part that is fixated in our own mind that was hurt, it still is almost kind of bigger than our like when you were talking about big self and small self, is that what you're saying? That is big self and small self. It's almost like, you know, one of our small selves that is still holding on to that, right? And I feel when we sit and when we practice and we allow for bigger self to integrate and become bigger, that the smaller selves can see that. They're kind of in there and they're looking. They're like, oh, maybe I'm not so fixated. Maybe I won't be hurt the same, in the same way if I trust big self that I have the capacity to meet this person. Maybe meet the hurt. Maybe meet the fear. Maybe meet the anger, you know. But I have that capacity. I think that's what practice is. Sitting and then maybe recognizing, seeing these small selves and seeing. So if I can't meet with that person that has hurt me, I can still meet with that part inside of myself that has been hurt, and I can have a conversation with it. And after many, many, many conversations, just like Doug had been with the trees, you know, in different ways. And maybe sometimes that part realizes, oh, okay, maybe I am evolved. I'm not fixed, so maybe I can meet this situation. And just sometimes just softens by this conversation. It might be a very long conversation. That makes sense? It's like I'm rambling.
Yes, that's
nice. Thank you.
Yeah, you're describing how to deal with it in the moment, but there are also systems, and there are also systems that can inhibit that process and also help that process. And one of the things Jokoji has is, and maybe your temple too, is there are processes by which when something like that arises, it's like there is a path to go. And so if a teacher isn't appropriate, there are people, it's not just an affliction. It's not like, I say something rude to someone and then they come to me and say, hey, you were rude to me. I just say, get over it. That's how it used to be here. Swear to God, you know, there is a trouble here. It's like, Doug, get over it.
You could give the advice to sit.
or go sit some more, yeah. But when it's like, okay, there's a problem, I can go talk to this person. And once that avenue is opened up, that goes to, if it becomes of a certain variety, there are legal issues that actually arise and it has to actually be dealt with legally. Forms of harassment or forms of verbal or physical violence need to be addressed. And so if there are processes, then that can help resolve it. It's where it then gets into a bigger community dealing with those things. And so that's part of what has arisen in our community that's made it more healthy now, I think. Tim?
Yeah, along those lines, I remember when I was new to Minnesota Zen Center, I was talking to Bhuksho Long, and I asked him about, and he defined Buddhism. Rather succinctly, he said, you know, when you're on the plane, and there's a crying baby there on the plane. You need to go to the crying baby. And I was like, I would never go to the crying baby on the plane. I said, let me out of here. You know? He said, no, you need to go to the crying baby then. Not avoid it, like we were talking about. Because you're the crying baby.
Beautiful. Okay. There's about 40 minutes. Is that enough time to do a little yoga, Nora?
So there are two options. I can offer a long session tomorrow. I just checked with Annette and she would be grateful if I did that. Or I could offer two shorter ones, one today and one tomorrow. So whatever people would like to do. I don't want anybody to feel rushed, like trying to make it to dinner and everything. So.
Well, there will be time for probably 30 minutes of Zazen then to get the room organized, or not Zazen, but yoga. We're going to offer that now instead of Zazen. If you'd like to sit Zazen, you can probably go to a small Zendo and sit. And if you'd like to do yoga, there'll be some yoga here until it's time to wrap up and go to dinner on time. Okay.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.